Welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host this week, Tom Wheeler, Executive Director of the Environmental Protection Information Center. And we are doing our post-election wrap-up show. And joining me, I have a full slate of friends, colleagues, guests, whatever you are. Matt Simmons, legal fellow at Epic. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Tom.
Jen Kalt, Director of Humble Baykeeper. Hey, Jen.
Hey, everybody.
Larry Glass, Executive Director of the North Coast Environmental Center. Hey, Larry.
Hey, Tom, and nice to meet you, Matt.
And Scott Greeson, Conservation Director at Friends of the Eel River. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Tom. Hey, everybody.
All right, so we're doing a post-election wrap-up, and, you know, all politics is local or whatever that saying goes. So let's start local. Larry, I know that you had some thoughts about the Eureka City Council races. What you got?
Yeah, well, I mean, this isn't been an ongoing situation in Eureka with the politics and with the local Democratic Central Committee, where they choose to weigh in with endorsements on what are considered nonpartisan offices. And sometimes it's been helpful, you know, especially when there's only two candidates, but sometimes there's a real downside to it. And the last election was a perfect example, Ward 4. There was a number of candidates that were, well, at least there were two candidates that were very good candidates. And the Central Committee, without a whole lot of fanfare, just decided to anoint one as their chosen person. And that was Lisa Welch, who I believe was an outstanding candidate. I'm saying nothing bad about her. But I just thought it was unfortunate that the Central Committee just chose to get in on her side. And there was a lot of chatter on the internet about that. A lot of, you know, it was pretty surprising to me because Scott was such a strong candidate and has such great credentials and is going to be such an asset to the city of Eureka. And I hope that we need to let the people decide, especially now that we're going to have ranked choice voting in Eureka.
And I had a somewhat similar thought, which was not necessarily frustration at the Democratic Party, but a bit of surprise at the relative weight of the Democratic Party endorsement. Larry, as you mentioned, Liza Welch received the endorsements of the North Coast People's Alliance, the Green Party, the Dems, and had a number of labor endorsements as well. And I kind of figured that in a race with a lot of candidates, and I didn't think anyone had particularly high name identification, that endorsements were going to play a more prominent role. And I think that Scott Bauer surprised a lot of people, including myself, but it is a testament to the importance of the ground game in elections. Scott knocked, I think, on just about every door in his ward and had good voter contact. So, you know, you can't ignore what are the tried and true methods of winning local elections, which is face-to-face voter contact. And we had good elections elsewhere, unless, Scott, you want to jump in on Eureka again.
Yeah, I just want to follow up with Larry and Jen maybe for a second. As someone outside of Eureka, except for my office, and I don't pay a lot of attention to the details of politics in Eureka, but it seems like one of the issues that's coming back on the table that's been a real bugbear for the environmental movement is the proposal to develop roads along the waterfront. And I'm just wondering what y'all's take as, you know, more consistent observers would be on how results of the election are likely to change that direction, if any.
I think that Scott Bauer, as an environmental scientist with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, has a really strong knowledge of state and federal environmental laws. One thing that we often see with local governments is the power of staff to kind of sway the decision makers on the city council, unless you have a city council member who really has significant background knowledge on the subject or invests a lot of time. So I think that that might be important for that sort of an issue. Larry.
It's one of the things that I had extensive conversations with Scott about when he decided to run was this problem that the city's been experiencing for the last decade, where staff is just almost performing the role of the city council and basically guiding the city.
And looking at other election results, Measure A in Arcata is going to pass. So we will have more park and open space funding, which is fantastic. Thank you, Arcata voters. Measure H in Eureka, which is just investment in local government, but is going to be pretty important in the time of economic downturns and loss of city revenue, is likely going to pass, as is ranked choice voting, which I think was Measure C this year. So,
well, and I should note that as of the first post-election report, the race between second district Humboldt County Supervisor Estelle Fennell and her primary challenger, whose name has just jumped out of my head, so I have to look for it.
Pardon me. Michelle Bushnell.
Is still only 200 votes apart with out of 8,000 votes cast in that race. So that's one that has yet to be decided that could be consequential.
Pretty surprising too. Estelle is a good retail politician, but it speaks to the difficulty of her district, I think, where you have folks voting against her in the more liberal districts, parts of her district, because she is too conservative. And then you have folks in Fortuna, the more conservative part of her district, voting against her because she's too liberal. So it's a tough district for someone to hold or to hold for a long time. So we'll continue to watch that one. Jen.
I thought it was interesting that virtually, I think, every tax measure that was on the ballot in Humboldt County passed. And that includes the Arcata Fire Protection District, as well as some sales tax increases. And then the fantastic Measure A in Arcata, which will be similar to the, I think it's called Measure B in McKinleyville, which is a $35 a year parcel tax. But in McKinleyville, it's just for parks and open space. And in Arcata, it will also be for wetland protections, which are wetland restoration, trails, and other aspects of protecting the environment and restoring wetlands and all this, you know, really, really great stuff. So kudos to Arcata for what is it? I think 78% of people voted for it. So,
which I think kind of lines up with the vote for Joe Biden in Humboldt County. So obviously the federal elections up here weren't terribly close. Joe Biden ran away with the Humboldt County vote, although it was significantly closer in other parts of the country.
As a political scientist, I want to note that the vote for Arcata taxes was about 3-1, where the vote for the Democratic slate for president was about 2-1 in Humboldt. So it was big.
Okay, there we go.
But, you know, even bigger for taxes. So.
It looks like the Trump administration will be limited to 4 years. He is going to be the first incumbent not reelected.
You got your fingers crossed there, buddy?
I mean, all of the major networks have called it, and currently Joe Biden's lead in Pennsylvania, for example.
There's no doubt that Joe Biden won the election. The question is whether Trump is going to, allow that to happen. And
I don't think that America is that weakened yet. I don't believe the hype that we are going to have an effective coup. But if we do, you'll hear about it first here on the
Economist Report. It tells us that things are much worse than we thought, that the barriers are down, and it, you know, may or may not be an effort to, you know, create a future revenue stream or a future base to, you know, run the Republican Party from, but it definitely delegitimizes any Democratic administration going forward. And that seems to me, that's the reason I brought it up, really, is that there's an effort already underway to undermine, delegitimize, and basically create friction on any effort by Democrats, you know, to roll back or to advance any progressive policy agenda, including environmental protection.
Yeah, I think he's setting this up for a ruling in exile. That's what this is all about, and trying to make a profit while he does.
In Saudi Arabia, yeah.
Yeah.
I do appreciate all of those points, but the fact remains that most likely on January 20th, we're going to have a new president, President Joseph R. Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris. I think that we can anticipate some pretty major changes at the federal level. And there's going to be certainly rollback of the Trump rollbacks of environmental law. So we'll see environmental laws go back to what they normally were before the Trump administration. One of my bright spots is that we survived 4 years of Trump without any significant legislative change to federal environmental laws, in part because of infighting within the Republican Party, and in part because the inability of the Trump administration to have consistent political appointees to write this legislation before the Democratic Party retook the House in 2018. So that's the bright side, and things like Paris Climate Accord it can be undone on the first day with just a stroke of the pen. So some things will go fast and some things will go slow. Larry.
Yeah, I just wanted to speak up on Senator Vice President-elect Harris's part. She has been a strong advocate for wilderness during her time as a senator. And that was a lot of people had billed her as not being particularly interested in the environment. I found working with her office that she was very interested in the environment, and I think she's going to be, in her new role, a great help to us as we try and roll back all the nonsense that the Trump administration done.
That's a great point. And, you know, she was a co-sponsor of Congressman Huffman's Public Lands Act, the big new wilderness bill. The Public Lands Act passed now twice through the House of Representatives, and it hasn't gotten through the Senate yet. And I'm not sure what it means that our Senate co-sponsor is now leaving the Senate, if that makes our chances worse. I kind of think that having her in the White House and having wilderness designation be a priority of the vice president, seeming priority of the vice president, would likely be good for us. Matt.
I was just going to say Vice President-elect Harris has also shown a lot of support for environmental justice issues, both as an attorney general and as a senator. And so I'm really excited to see, you know, hopefully her voice leading to more of that in the Biden administration.
Yeah, the wilderness bill is now in the included in the National Defense Authorization Act. So we may see some movement on that shortly, because that's a must-pass bill.
Given my role here is to dump on you, Tom, I want to note that Kamala Harris is not leaving the Senate as vice president. She'll be the president of the Senate, which could be extremely important in the event that the two Georgia Senate runoff races come out with Democratic victories and we wind up with a 50-50 Senate. She will then have the tie-breaking role. And it's, you know, I think extremely likely, given President-elect Biden's history of long service with the Senate, that both of them are going to have a lot of work ahead, you know, working with at least the Democratic members of the Senate. The open question, of course, is whether they can break the freeze that Senate Republicans have imposed on all Democratic action since the beginning of the Obama administration.
Yeah, so we don't know who will control the Senate until those January runoff elections. And it's possible that we'll have unified government, which puts even more power into the Democratic Party's hands.
The 50-50 Senate is barely, but yeah, yeah.
Right. As you said, Scott, before, you know, we'll still be stuck with Senator Manchin of West Virginia.
Right.
Much worse, we're stuck with Mitch McConnell. That's the real problem. He has managed to twist the rules of the Senate in ways that the Senate has never used since the days of segregation. So it's, you know, he's the real problem.
Yeah, well, so you know, if we get to 50, our odds of doing something more consequential on the environment improve, and we need to do things that are consequential, right?
Exactly. So we let's talk about that. Yeah,
we lost 4 years with the Trump administration on climate change, for example.
If you think about that metaphor of unrolling the rollbacks of, you know, taking that turf that the Trump administration has scraped up off the lawn and rolled back up, you know, and stuck off to the side. When we roll it back out, it's not going to be as good as it was before. It's not going to be enough for the challenges we face now. We've lost 4 years of really important time, especially on the climate front, but also on biodiversity protection. And I think, you know, the larger point I've seen made in the popular press is that those impacts are going to be the most consequential environmental impacts of the Trump administration, the progress we've lost, really.
Yeah, there was an opportunity cost. We've got
more bad vehicles on the road now that are going to be there for longer. And you know,
it's going to have a lingering effect, right? So one of the things of the Trump administration was having weaker fuel economy standards. So we're going to have less fuel efficient vehicles, 4 years of less fuel efficient vehicles on the road for the entirety of their lifespan.
Remarkably, the intense focus by the Republican Party over the last 4 years on fossil fuel energy, on the old dinosaurs, doesn't seem to have worked for them economically. And it doesn't seem to have worked for the oil companies and the coal companies. You know, they're all going broke, you know? So the change is happening, you know, and it's pretty apparent that if we can get, you know, the country to start moving in that direction deliberately, we'll have the wind at our backs. But
yeah, we had a relative decline of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States in 2019, but it wasn't because of anything that the Trump administration did. It was just natural changes to the economy, most particularly a reduction in coal production and a loss of natural gas exports to Europe because we weren't doing things good enough in the United States for European standards. So a lot of things can be undone pretty quickly with the Trump administration. You know, we get back in the Paris Climate Accord, but we have this opportunity lost here, as we talked about. The other big loss, I think, from the Trump administration is the really jerking rightward swing of the judiciary. This was something that began in the Obama administration with the denial of Democrat-appointed judges to get through the Senate confirmation process, which left more seats open than would normally or ordinarily be left open.
Yeah, this is a much bigger thing than the Supreme Court. This is the whole of the federal judiciary, district courts. The Court of Appeals have been their particular focus. But
yeah, and so seeing a record number of judges get through in the Trump administration, for example, one way that you can think about it is to look at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Obama, over 8 years, was able to get through 7 Court of Appeals judges on the Ninth Circuit, which has the reputation of being, you know, the lefty liberal West Coast hippie granola appellate court. It's
marginally
the one
realist. Yeah.
I'm speaking of national reputation, you know. So Obama got through 7 in 8 years. Trump got through 10 in 4 years, 10 judges in 4 years. So
let's be clear. That was Trump and McConnell. This is
Trump
very
and McConnell.
Much a Senate strategy.
This is a Senate strategy. And this is Mitch McConnell leading the Republican Party here.
Yeah, in cooperation with the Federalist Society, which has made sure that every one of these young judges is fervently committed to and has a demonstrated track record of far-right activism, especially for corporate interests. I think that's the thing most of us miss about the judicial disputes is they get framed so often in terms of the very consequential fights over Roe v. Wade, that, you know, abortion rights or civil rights or you know, campaign issues, that we've missed the fact that the central issue for the Federalist Society types is fealty to corporate power. And we now have a Supreme Court that's 6-3, absolutely gonzo for big money. And it's the most frightening thing I've seen in my whole life.
So again, like climate change, this is a lingering effect of the Trump administration that will be felt for decades. by our Constitution, federal court judges are lifetime appointments. So these folks are going to serve until they die or no longer want to serve. And we got a bunch of young conservatives on the court now. So they're gonna stick around for four decades.
And without the Senate, this is going to continue on. You know, if Mitch McConnell still has the power, he'll just keep doing it.
So the great risk here, though, is that we do win a narrow majority in the Senate. You know, we hold on to the House and we pass, you know, some of the kind of legislation we desperately need, you know, to start moving forward to address the climate crisis. And then, you know, the Roberts Court takes it up and finds that, you know, the Constitution contains an absolute prohibition on Congress doing this sort of thing. And then we're really behind a rock, you know.
So we're in tough straits, right? Best case scenario, Democratic Party retains a House, wins over the Senate, a bare majority in the Senate, and we have the presidency. That's best case scenario. That allows kind of the most unified, aggressive action on environmental laws. Worst case scenario is that we have a divided government. And that the last decade where divisiveness and rancor and the loss of comedy in our government is pales in comparison to what comes ahead, in that the parties recognize that their political chances are best served by just being jerks and hating each other. Imagine what I might deem as the worst case scenario, which is we have divided government and we have a lack of willingness to engage in bipartisan discussions to try to move anything forward. And we have elections coming up that can swing parties, swing the House back to the Republicans, and then we have an even more divided government. So with that in mind, what are we trying to do? What is our plan for the worst case scenario?
The thing is, Tom, I think we need to start with recognizing that the kind of stuff we are talking about, the policies we are advocating for, are phenomenally popular. You know, the vast majority of Americans support rational action to deal with climate change. It's very, very popular. So, you know, we, I think, always need to start with that understanding that it's not the current situation is not a reflection of the popular will.
Although the popular will has been subverted by our Constitution, which allows minoritarian government.
Ding.
We face a lot of structural challenges. For a group of people who want to go a far distance very quickly, especially when it comes to climate change, which is going to require a major restructuring our economy in a way that's going to be very scary for a lot of people. Is it possible to pin hopes at the federal level, or do we need to start doing other sort of organizing? One thing that I think was helpful in of the Trump administration was that it taught us to not rely on the federal government as much. And so you saw things like compacts between blue states or states that would want to take on climate change. So you had the Pacific Coast Collaborative, a group of states, including states and provinces, British Columbia, Washington, Oregon, and California, who decided to take direct action on climate change. And you have local governments and statewide governments doing bold, exciting things. Governor Newsom's action on electric vehicles, 100% by 2035, I think is huge. You know, California is what, the seventh or eighth largest economy on the planet. And so people build to the California standard. So I think that the environmental movement in some respects needs to become far more conservative and lean into the idea of states' rights and then just use our position as the party that has the states with the most population in the United States to get the things done that we need to get done.
Which raises the question, A, who is Governor Newsom going to appoint to fill Kamala Harris's seat? B, what's going to happen to the Delta now that the feds aren't pushing an insane, illegal water grab? You know, Newsom supported it. Is he going to, you know, get on the side of good vibes now?
Nah. It'll be interesting to see what the relationship is between the state of California and the federal government in a Biden administration. I would hope that we continue to press the federal government to go further faster as a state and to not let our foot off the gas. But we risk complacency.
Yeah, I was just thinking about what you were saying about federalism, and I support it, but I think it's important to remember that a lot of the problems we face aren't federalized, right? Like, you know, pollution crosses state lines, climate change affects everyone.
Right.
And I know that the election results, even with a win, are depressing. I just don't know that I'm ready to give up on federal action. And so with everything we just said, I don't know what the path forward is. And so I was Googling around, and everyone has written there, like, here are the first five things Biden can do without anyone's permission. But they're, you know, they're sort of timid things. You know, a lot of it's just going back to business as usual under Obama.
No, but it's a good thought. And there's what we'll see as the legislative deficiencies of the Trump administration could be the problem of the Biden administration too. And they were the problems of the Obama administration because we had a Congress that refused to do anything, which is, unless you get it through Congress, it is susceptible to change and fast and quick change from the federal agency or from the federal side. So the quickest things that you can undo are executive orders, which just requires a day one executive order that rescinds all previous executive orders issued by the last president. And, you know, day two, then you start on your rulemaking, and that's going to take you a little bit more time. But with a competent staff, you should be able to roll back the rollbacks, as I said before. You should be able to reinsert the previous interpretations of rules within a two-year period.
Noting that there will, of course, be furious resistance from the fossil fuel interests and the other bad actors who drove all this, you know, wastage in the first place.
And one thing that we can also learn from the Trump administration is to do it right, and do it right the first time. So much of the Trump administration's rulemaking agenda was thwarted by Trump himself in some respects, right? It was the Muslim travel ban, where a judge pointed back and said, well, you said it was a Muslim travel ban, and now you're just saying it is a restriction on travel from, you know, certain countries. I can't trust you. And to do it by the processes that are required and not try to take shortcuts and end-arounds, right? We need to do this right so that we can survive the inevitable challenges that will come. After all of this, how is everyone feeling on a scale of 1 to 10 about their hope for the future? Scott, we might need to, like, you know, what is it? Grade on a curve for you there?
Yeah. Well, I have this great t-shirt. It's completely worn out, but I keep it because I love it so much. It says, there's hope, but not for us. You know, that's been my attitude for many, many years. You know, our job is to, you know, keep the options open. But this is a long struggle. And, you know, you asked, should we be working at the federal level or the state level or the local level? The answer is yes. We got to use every tool in the toolbox. But that means learning to use the tools in the right situations, you know, appropriately and effectively. And that doesn't come immediately.
Larry, how are you feeling about the Biden administration?
I feel good, though I have to characterize it as, you know, we put a tourniquet on the wound. We're still bleeding, but we're not going to bleed out here in the next year. But we're in trouble, and we need first aid.
Matt, how about you?
I'm very worried about our minoritarian system, and especially as, you know, certain states continue to get bigger and certain states continue to get smaller in comparison. And the Senate continues to be a institution where, you know, the senator from Wyoming gets as much representation as the senator from California. I don't know how long that can last, you know, where we keep seeing a president win the popular vote by 4 or 5 million people, but not really be able to, you know, change anything. And so I'm just from like a pure like political, you know, how does that keep going? I'm not sure.
Good concerns. Jen, how are you feeling?
Well, I'm worried too, but first and foremost, I'm really looking forward to the restoration of science in its rightful place in a global pandemic. And the fact that the Biden-Harris team instituted the coronavirus task force on the first day after the election was declared won by them is really helpful. I'm also really excited that the March for Science announced a political action committee. And, you know, for way too many years, scientists have refused to be advocates because they felt that it tainted their science. And I think that era has been completely upended. And so a lot more scientists are ready to fight for what they know and love. And that often is nature, clean water, clean air, public health, social justice, climate change, mitigation measures that we all know we need to work towards. So,
well, Jen, I think that that is a wonderful place to leave it on the high note. Amen. So thank you. And thanks to all of you for joining us here today on the Eco News Report. Tune in to the Eco News Report every weekend on the same time and channel.